Hello everyone, I am Anae Ashwin, and welcome to the first episode of I Am Not a Rocket Scientist. This enlightening series demystifies the notion that space careers are only for those with backgrounds in physics or engineering. Each episode shines a light on the diverse roles that make space exploration possible. Today we have an amazing guest, Ms. Lauren Fell, who will be kicking off this podcast and sharing her space journey with us. Lauren wears many hats. She is a lecturer at the Queensland University of Technology. She is an entrepreneur and a space enthusiast. She is leading the outreach program for Lunar Outpost Oceania, the program which will see boot prints on the moon again. But this time, we are here to stay. So, Lauren, please tell the audience about your journey, how you got to space from your education to the different paths that you took to get here.
Thank you, Anae, and very pleased to be speaking with you today. So, for me, I didn't start in a traditional kind of field that you would imagine most space professionals would be in. But my journey is actually shared by a lot of people in the space industry, particularly here in Australia. We come from many different backgrounds. So my background's in psychology, actually. I was very bad at maths in school, I will admit saying, but I really enjoyed sort of physics and learning about space. So I ended up going into psychology because I felt it would fit me more, but I still was drawn to space and the really exciting ideas and opportunities there. And one day I received an email from a platform that does crowdsource challenges, telling sort of announcing a challenge that was available on their platform from NASA. And I had a go and was fortunate enough to win and just kept going from there. And that kind of launched my career in space because I was able to share ideas that didn't need a sort of a background or didn't need a formal education to sort of promote. It was just the ideas themselves that spoke for themselves. And that was really helpful for me to get into a totally new field that I didn't have any experience in.
Yeah, wow, that sounds really interesting. It's really interesting to see how you've taken this path to get into space. And so, yeah, I understand that you are doing a PhD that is related to space. Could you explain to me a little bit more about that?
Yes, certainly. So quantum cognition is a weird kind of integration between psychology and physics. So essentially, the way I like to talk about it is when we make decisions with intuition as humans, which is basically most of the decisions that we make day to day, all these ones that you don't even notice you're making these decisions, these intuitive decisions often don't conform to what we would expect people would, the process people would make to make a decision if we're assuming that they were totally rational and logical and that we sort of thought through all of the pros and cons and sort of everything in a really systematic way or a computational kind of way. So because we have this unusual way of thinking for most of our decisions day to day, and because they basically allow us to make so many decisions that we make every day without having to use a lot of the sort of brain power, we need to find a theory that really explains and helps us understand how those decisions are made. And just like when quantum physics first was discovered, a little over 100 years ago, it was something that was, or less than 100 years ago, don't quote me on that. When they realized that small particles behaved in a really unusual way, it turns out that the unusual kind of probabilities and the ways that they behave can be applied, those concepts can be applied to the unusual ways in which we think.
Okay.
So just like quantum particles don't behave rationally, quote unquote, as to how, Newtonian physics works at a sort of large scale and what we see day to day, under the surface, our sort of intuitive decision-making, intuitive thinking also doesn't really conform to that rational, logical way that we would assume we make decisions. So applying that to how we make intuitive trust decisions, which is a super basic decision that we make, it's something that we make very quickly, and it's really important to our evolution as a species to be able to trust and make those trust decisions. And I specifically apply that in space. So when astronauts go out into this extremely volatile, extremely uncertain, unknown environment, trust becomes a really, really important thing for them. So that's what my main focus is.
Wow, that's really interesting. I've actually had a look at some quantum physics before. So it is mind-boggling
yes.
what tiny particles could do. And to apply it to psychology and how we as humans can make trust, how, as you mentioned, rational decisions can be made very quickly just by meeting someone briefly.
Yes, definitely. And I think to give you one example, if you're familiar with the quantum concepts, one of the most well-known ones is Schrodinger's cat, where it's alive and dead. So that can be similar to when you might be in two minds about something. You both really want, you know, to eat a pizza and really don't want to eat a pizza or something like that. But you're able to sort of collapse, if you will, that decision very quickly. And that process of collapsing isn't really about weighing up the pros and cons and doing all the rational processes. It happens just as quickly as you might think about a quantum particle collapsing into, you know, spin up or spin down, or a cat being alive or dead when you open the box.
That's actually a really good analogy to view this and trust. And I've recently read in the Cosmos magazine that you were part of an analog mission. I will attach the link to that article in the bio. So tell us a little bit more about that. As a Lord of the Rings fan, I am particularly intrigued about Mordor.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm thinking of some other sci-fis brought to mind. Not only when you trust not enough, but also when you trust too much. So I'm reminded of Aliens and the android that everyone assumed was a human and then turned out to be bad. And this can also happen. So one thing that I was quite interested in looking at in the habitat was calibration of trust. So it's not just important to ensure that you're building trust and making sure it's the most, everyone's trusting each other at the highest level. It's also about metering that with when do we need to know that we can't trust a decision or can't trust a person or a piece of equipment or something. But Mordor was quite a scary experience. It took me by surprise because I wasn't anticipating it, but we walked up this sort of steep hill, which in itself was just reminded me of Samwise Gamgee and Frodo scrambling up that last little bit to Mordor. And then as soon as we got to the top of it, rounding a corner, our commander casually mentioned through the comms in our suits that, oh, by the way, this hole here, don't fall into it. If you throw a rock down there, you can't hear it hit the bottom. It's that deep.
Wow.
And it was just a hole in the ground. Everything else was normal ground, and then it just an empty gaping hole, and that was, yeah, and there was no, I don't know, in Australia everything is very regulated and everything is safety and all of that, but you know, in a unique environment like top of a volcano.
Just for the viewers, whereabouts was your analog mission?
It was in Hawaii on the Big Island. It was on top of a volcano, and an active volcano. In fact, the volcano next to it had erupted just the year prior, which put off a lot of the missions, and they were very nervous about the lava hitting the habitat, but it was fine. So yeah, it was a really interesting landscape, and it did look otherworldly, and it did have these elements like holes in the ground and lava tubes, which we also went through and were able to practice that sort of exploration part of space exploration, being able to really discover and find your way in a totally unknown environment. So that was really interesting.
Wow. I don't know too many people that can say that they have been an astronaut in an analog mission. Congratulations.
Really? And it's something that I would really encourage any of your viewers and yourself to look into those opportunities, because there's a lot of habitats that are around the world, and it's a really unique opportunity to do research and be embedded in that research, and also just have that experience of, is this something that I want to do? If you're interested in being an astronaut, test it out. Is this something I can handle for 2 weeks? Some of the missions there have been a year long, which I can imagine would be Very stressful.
The best way to learn about something is to do it.
Really eloquently put, Lauren. You are the founder of Lunaria One. So firstly, how did you get into entrepreneurship? And tell us a little bit more about your mission.
Yeah, so it's a similar sort of style to the challenges. If you sort of have an idea and you don't have the background to sort of back it up, sometimes it's easy to just do it yourself and see how it goes. And so entrepreneurial activities are a bit like that, where you might have an idea, and if you've got enough drive to sort of put it out there in the world and see how it goes, you can do that. And so I did a few things with the various ideas that I had. And Lunaria One is a culmination of myself and an engineer, an aerospace engineer, who knows what he's talking about more so than me. We came together and we're looking for a space project that we could send up to the moon. We landed on this idea of plants in space, because it's such a simple and also vital thing to be able to grow plants for mental health, for food, for oxygen, for all sorts of reasons. And this project is a really early step towards having plants more sustainably on the moon. And the more that we can learn about how to sustainably put them and grow them up there, the more we can learn about how we can better grow crops here on Earth as well. So it has that sort of dual process, which many space missions do. And yeah, we're working hard on the engineering front, the biology front, and also our really important outreach front and getting the public and the Australians involved.
Wow, that sounds really amazing, Lauren. Putting seeds on the moon is, again, something out of science fiction. And to see how it would work, because they've started growing things in the ISS, and it is crucial for long duration space missions because food is heavy and it burns through quite quickly. So if you can grow your own food, especially in some of the most inhospitable places known to man, it's really going to help us push the envelope and to get to the moon, Mars, and beyond.
Yeah.
So what are some of the plants that you are thinking of sending up?
Yeah, so just to add to that, like speaking from my own experience, it's heavy to sort of send food up, but also the food that you can send up, it's very boring after a while.
Yes.
It's freeze-dried, you know, powdered food is just not pleasant. So the benefit, the sort of health and mental health benefits of having something fresh like lettuce, and they have experimented a lot with these kind of nice, crisp, fresh ingredients that are also very healthy. We're sort of going back to basics because there's a few things that we need to check and de-risk. So a lot of space missions are about very small steps. So, you know, if you spend a huge amount of money and effort and time on getting something to the moon, you want to make sure that it works. So you've got to sort of scale back and do things one step at a time. So I would love to send a whole garden up there and with some mushrooms for protein and some, you know, lettuce and to make a whole salad and a whole meal. That would be lovely. But that's a few steps away. So we're starting with some very hardy, very tolerant species so that we have the best chance that we can collect some valuable data on how things can grow and survive that kind of environment. So we're looking at some seeds. We need them to be fast germinating because we have a very short period of time where we can collect data. So that gives us another interesting constraint. But out of constraints comes innovation. So we've got a fantastic biology team testing a whole range of species to see what will meet all of those requirements that we have. There's a pretty standard, like it's what you might imagine to be, you know, it's the species that everyone uses for everything kind of thing. It's a standard testing species called Arabidopsis. And that's definitely a candidate because that's been flown on a lot of other space missions. And so we have a nice baseline data for that. So that's something that's being considered.
Okay.
There's other sort of species, fast growing species like radish type species that are looked at. But we're also looking at what are called resurrection species. And these have this unique ability to lose almost all their water. And then as soon as and basically die. It looks like dead grass. But as soon as you reintroduce water, the dead parts or the dead-looking parts come back to life. And so the cells are really specialized to be able to survive this kind of cycle of dehydration and rehydration. And that makes them really, really resilient. They can survive a huge range of very harsh conditions, a huge range of temperatures, which is really important because there's a lot of temperature swings on the way to the moon and on the moon, and also allows us to send something that has a really good chance of surviving so that we can see something if other species maybe don't survive. So it's a sort of trying to achieve a variety so that we have the best chance of survival.
Well, plants that can be dehydrated of water and brought back to life, that is weird.
It is weird, yes. Yes.
In like the show Three-Body Problem, they do it with humans, but it's just like in a game simulation type thing. But to actually see it done in real life with plants is out of this world.
And it is, and hopefully we'll be out of this world soon.
Hopefully.
Yeah, so it's they're amazing species, and they can do it really, really quickly. So overnight they can go from dead to alive, which is, a nice surprise if you've got a dead house plant, and then if you were to wake up one day and suddenly it's alive, that would be a nice thing to have.
I think they are underappreciated.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there's so many, there's so much rich diversity on our planet that we have a lot right here that we can draw on. And there's all sorts of applications for learning from various natural processes that have, evolved in their own ways, that we don't have to reinvent the wheels sometimes. We can just use what we can learn from things that have done their own job at surviving and growing and thriving.
That's how we progress forward. We use what we have and then make it innovative.
Yeah.
Well done with this. It's a really unique idea. You mentioned that you've got some biologists on your team. So what are the other different jobs, different other people that you have to help you with sending seeds to the moon?
Yeah, so we're working with quite a number of partners. So we've got some university partners, so QUT, RMIT, ANU, and some universities overseas as well.
Right.
We're also working with aerospace engineering companies and companies that help with radiation testing, because there's a lot of testing that needs to be done with the payload that we're sending up to make sure that it's ready to go and it will survive. And also some startups and smaller companies that are looking at problems here on Earth and solving problems here on Earth. So we're working with Micropod, which is a desk benchtop microgreens company, as well as Invertigrow, who are a vertical farming company. And so they're looking at ways that you can sustainably and efficiently grow things here on Earth, which if you think about it, when you're trying to innovate and trying to meet the really harsh conditions of the moon and of out of space.
Best to do it here in somewhere where we can easily test it before you send it up there.
Certainly. And then learn things from when you have to do all these extreme kind of things to meet those conditions. What you learn from there will make it more sustainable here on Earth as well, where you do have the resources, but you hopefully don't have to use as many resources if you've already practiced with the very limited resources that you have up in space.
To our listeners, Lauren's Lunaria 1 is a great example of how you can take something so simple or a very specific interest that you may have, like gardening, growing plants, and putting it in space. So I commend you on that, Lauren.
Oh, thank you. I do have to admit, though, I have killed many a houseplant, so that's why we have a very expert biologist on the team. I don't go near the plants.
Well, I hope they'll grow back soon. So
yeah, well, I wish they were resurrection species.
I have recently watched your amazing TED talk that was really inspiring. And as you've mentioned, you have done a lot of competitions to get to where you are. So what advice would you give to our listeners about these competitions and how they are
good platforms to either test the waters or to expand your horizons?
Yeah, definitely. So that's a great question. Thank you. So my biggest advice would be just give it a go. So, you know, if there's something that you think might be an interesting challenge, be in it for the learning rather than the prize, because you might not always get the prize, you might not always win, but the most value you can get out of these is the involvement in a space initiative or whatever kind of interest you might have, as well as what you learn in that process along the way. So be in it for yourself and do it for the joy of doing it. If it's your interest, give it a go. Don't feel shy. There's so many people from so many backgrounds that do these, and that's the whole point of these challenges. In fact, it's better if you come from a different background, because they're generally not looking for solutions that are already existing. They're looking for out-of-the-box thinking. And if you're not an expert, you have out-of-the-box thinking. That's your main value. So take a look around. There's so many online, and it's sometimes hard to know that they exist. So for NASA challenges, go to the NASA Tournament Lab. If you're interested in, you know, coding or refining your skills there, you know, there's platforms specific to that. There's other platforms that are specific to engineering. If you're not an engineer, that's okay. Go ahead, give it a go. So, you know, the unique perspective that you have is valued on these platforms. So as long as you're interested in it will be fun for you anyway, regardless of whether you win. That's a good tester for whether you should compete or not.
That is some great advice to our audience. It is a great way to get interested in space and to take some of your interests and seeing how they can be applicable to space. While the prize may not be everything, they are a good motivator. As
definitely, yeah. One of the, I think the biggest prize that I got was $15,000, and that was only, it was an AI challenge, and I'm not a coder. I've, you know, dabbled, but I'm not a coder. And the reason that I won that was their feedback was, it was a trust in AI project, you know, challenge, and apparently I was the only person that actually talked about humans in the thing. So there must have been a lot of, you know, software engineers and AI specialists that were trying to solve the problem of, say, accuracy or something else. But what they were looking for was trust, which is a uniquely human thing. And so because I had that outside perspective, I, you know, wasn't coming at it from an engineering or a software perspective, that's what gave me that advantage. And that was a really nice kind of prize and, you know, helped me sort of fund other challenges that, you know, where I was looking at robotics and buying things for that. So they can often springboard off each other, which is handy.
Wow. And to our viewers, you don't need to have money or a lot of resources to do these challenges. All you just need is an interest, something to get your ideas down and to convey them with the world, and we will see what happens. Lastly, I would like to congratulate Lauren on being the finalist for the Australian Space Summit Awards 2024.
And while we're congratulating, congratulations to you also for your place in the Big Dipper Challenge.
Thanks, Lauren.
As you know very well, the benefits of crowdsourcing challenges. So congratulations on that. It was very impressive to be up against teams of engineers and still sort of beat those teams. So very well done.
Thanks, Lauren. And as we wind down this podcast, before you go, Lauren, can you please tell the listeners that you are not a rocket scientist?
I'm not a rocket scientist, but I am a space innovator and hopefully one day a space psychologist.
Wow, that is so eloquently put to sum up this amazing journey. Thank you so much for being on the show, Lauren.
Pleasure to be.